Hello and welcome to Fantasy Talks Live, the podcast that came out of the Jose's Amazing World's YouTube channel. Original video recordings of all the episodes in the podcast can be found at Jose's Amazing World's in YouTube. Listeners beware, as plot spoilers can be discussed in any of the episodes in the podcast. And now, without further delay, enjoy the show. We're live. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, anyone watching live now or later on. It is my absolute pleasure to have here tonight author Tim Akers, author of the Burn Cycle and the Hallowed War series, amongst others. Tim, thank you very much for being here.
Jose, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
No. The pleasure is all mine. We were talking a little bit before going live, but I always want to start this. If you can summarize what's been your journey to the point where you've become a very prolific and established author, because I guess people don't know, you've got almost as many books out there as Brandon Sanderson, and you also share agents with him. So,
correct. Yeah. And our histories actually align pretty similarly. I just haven't had quite as much success as Brandon has. So I started writing when I was a kid, and that was what I always wanted to do. When I got to college, I decided that maybe I was going to be a game designer instead. I play a lot of D&D and similar games, and I thought that was going to be my career. And then Magic the Gathering came out. I love Magic. I play Magic. But it really devastated the role-playing game community for a while. So I got out of that business and I started focusing mostly on fiction writing again. I sold my first professional short story in, I want to say, 2003. I did some game writing in the 90s. I wrote for White Wolf Game Studio, for Atlas, for Mayfair, for some smaller companies. And then I put that aside and focused on fiction, and ended up selling my first short story in 2003. I met Joshua Bilmus, which is Brandon's agent and my agent, at a convention in Wisconsin in 2005. And Brandon's first book wasn't out yet, but he had signed and he had his contract, and we met at a party. I mean, I say we met. We passed each other at a party in Wisconsin, and Joshua was introducing him to his editor for the first time, Moshe Fetter. And I didn't know who he was. All I knew was that he was the dream client, or the sort of the star client, star client of Joshua, and Joshua was the guy I wanted to sign with. So I went out and I read Elantris and really enjoyed it. And shortly after that, I signed with Brandon, or with Joshua. And interestingly, my first book came out in 2009, which is the same year that Mistborn was published. And in fact, our covers, I happen to have it here just by chance. We have the same cover artist, John Foster. And it, you know, for various reasons, my book didn't take off that well. Mistborn did, and the rest is kind of history. My 13th book comes out in May. I'm a pretty persistent and determined writer. But I quit my day job and started writing full time in 2012. So I've been at it for a little over a decade. And yeah, I just keep putting out books and doing the only thing I know how to do, which is write sort of a weird epic fantasy.
That's great. And out of curiosity, so you signed with an agent on the back of what? Like, what did you have that caught his attention? Was it because you already sold your first story, but what did you have there ready to go?
So when I met Joshua, I did not have a novel written. I was selling short stories to various magazines. I was selling a lot of short stories to Interzone, which is the largest science fiction magazine in the UK. And I had some, I actually did have a young adult novel that I had finished that I didn't particularly like, but he looked at that and said, well, there's some skill here. You know, let's open the dialogue. Let's continue, you know, conversations and stuff. And that book has never seen the light of day. But shortly after that, I sold my first novel, Heart of Eridon, to a publisher, Solaris Books, which at the time was an imprint of Black Library, which is Games Workshop's, that's their imprint. And it was really just kind of on the back of a pitch. I didn't have a completed novel, and that's rare. It's rare to sell a book that's not written yet. But I, you know, they were looking for new authors, and I wrote a good pitch. I wrote a good first, about half of the book, and they bought it based on that half. And so I was already talking to Joshua, and I called him and said, hey, I've got an offer. Would you be willing to be my agent? And he asked to see the manuscript first, wisely. And then he offered representation. So that was about 2007, I want to say, somewhere in there. So that was my journey. That is unusual. And really the path, like my goal was to write a bunch of short stories, catch the attention of an agent, which I did. And then move to novels and do that full time. For various reasons, my first three novels honestly didn't do that well. Each of them, for their own reason, kind of ran into problems. But, you know, publishing is the ability to face persistent rejection and just keep going. And that's kind of what I've done. That's how I got there. I don't think you can do that now. I think honestly, you know, short story markets are not what they were in the early 2000s. They really weren't what they were even 5 years ago. And very few agents are going to be willing to look at anything that's not a completed novel. I don't think any would be, honestly. And you're really not going to sell to a publisher with an incomplete novel or incomplete novel. That's an unusual path. And I think in retrospect, I really would have probably done better if I'd had a completed book. You know, I would have been in a better position to like potentially go to auction or draw the attention of additional publishers. But I was desperate to sell. And a lot of aspiring writers are, I think, at that stage.
I mean, and to be honest, You've made it. You make a living out of writing the stories that you want to write.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And you know, you are traditionally published. You got your agent. I mean, you know, you've made it. Maybe it's just a case of how, you know, whatever the next book is, isn't it? Even Sanderson got, you know, Elantris is not his first book by any means.
No. I believe it was his sixth novel overall.
Exactly.
Something like that. So, yeah, I mean, it takes time to, you know, the only way to learn how to write a novel is to write a novel. And the fact that my second novel that I wrote, you know, the young adult novel was the first, is on shelves is unusual. And I think every novel I write is better than the last one. So I kind of feel like I hit my stride probably with Wraithbound, which is my, I don't even know, eighth novel, ninth novel, something like that. It's my eighth novel. That's sort of where I'm like, actually, where I feel like I'm honestly getting as good as I can be, or at least, you know, really kind of writing as well as I want to write. I can look back at my old novels and say, well, here's what didn't go well there. And here's what didn't go well there. Ironically, one of my favorite novels of mine is still my first. I still think I absolutely wrote the novel that I intended to write with that. So hello, Drew.
So I was going to say, the main reason I wanted to talk to you is because you mentioned to me privately when we were exchanging emails that you've dedicated time to sort of tracking and sort of analyzing the changing of the fantasy genre industry, for want of a better expression. And one of my sort of, it's a video that I made like a couple of years ago, but for some reason it's gained traction recently. It's been there for 2 years and all of a sudden it's just jumped to like a few thousand views or whatever.
Right.
Which is what I talked about, sort of the problems with modern fantasy, where I don't think modern fantasy is very fantastical. You know, I grew up, and again, we were talking off camera, like you, playing Dungeons and Dragons. I come from that Forgotten Realms, Dragonlance, Lord of the Rings background. And to see a lot of modern authors, no need to name names, but whose world building basically amounts to pseudo-historical European medieval fantasy, there's not a lot of fantasy in what is selling the most at the moment. Is that my perception only? Is that something you...
No, I would agree with that. And I mean, you know, genres change over time. When I got my start, the big thing was like the new weird, and that disappeared. And then everyone's writing grimdark, and then that kind of has... That's gotten more involved with like the... in independent publishing, there's a lot more grimdark, though that I kind of feel like they've lost the core of what grimdark should have been. Like, I really liked Joe Abercrombie. I liked his early stuff, the first Law trilogy. But he kind of lost me after that. He lost me after what was it called, Best Served Cold, when it was just horrible people doing horrible things to each other. And I'm like, why am I reading this? What's the point? And in independent publishing, they call a lot of things grimdark when it's just violent, and that's not the same thing. It's, you know, grimdark was a reaction to a specific kind of fantasy. This is just leaning into like horrible things. Yay, who cares? So no, I would agree. Like, when you walk into, I don't know how things are in Spain, but when I walk into a bookstore around here in the Midwest or the US, the majority of it is like romanticy. It's like, it's romance novels sort of acting like they're fantasy novels, or fantasy novels where the primary driver is romance. And I can't blame publishers for that, because I'm a capitalist and there's definitely, you know, a drive for that, but they've really abandoned a lot of what, you know, what I think of as being traditional fantasy, and what sort of draws people's attention to fantasy, well, the things that bring the joy of fantasy, which is the fantastical, you know, it's the what ifs. It's one of the things that I think we've been talking about Sanderson a lot, but I think that he does well is he's really committed to like really high level world building, and that interconnectedness of things that I think a lot of fantasy just kind of abandons. One of the big things for me in writing and world creation is, you know, the cosmology of things, how religions work, how the big picture stuff functions. And then I bring it down to like plot and character and stuff. So yeah, I mean, the genre has really changed, but I don't know that it's gotten better. I don't know that it's actually like following what I would consider to be, you know, an interesting path. There are very few books that come out these days where I'm like, yay, I'm going to rush out and read that. But at the same time, there are some really good fantasy novels that are coming out. There's many fewer of them, and they really don't get a lot of attention. So, yeah. And if you walk into a bookstore, they're not on the shelves. So yeah. It's challenging to, as a writer, to write what you want to write and have it actually appear on shelves, if you're not already an established name. You know, a lot of things have changed as far as like the marketing and stuff, as far as I can tell.
No. I think I echo the sentiment, and you've touched on so many things there. But for one, to my mind, bookstores are just, you know, display cases for Amazon. People will go to a bookstore, see something they like, and then they'll get it for Amazon cheaper. Where you've got price competition. I don't know about the US, but in the UK, there's price competition with books, so no physical bookstore can sell cheaper than Amazon. Okay. In Spain, book prices are protected by law, so there's a maximum discount you can offer, so that way bookstores can actually compete with Amazon, but they haven't got the space to house everything that you can find. on Amazon.
Yeah, and I mean, I worked in bookstores through college and for a while after that. And so like the way that book covers I can talk about forever, but the way that bookstores have changed the way that they're able to stock, man, that is a whole can of worms, because you know, originally, like, there was Barnes and Noble and Borders, and they were really large, and you could walk in and find a lot of books. But at that time, when my books came out, or when, you know, books came out in general, you only had about 90 days to sell enough copies that the bookstore would consider it worth their time to actually keep on the shelf. And it was very difficult to get that kind of attention and to get enough books sold that you could actually remain on the shelf. And so that was called making the model, or making the algorithm, because you had to kind of, there was a, you know, a question of how much you had to sell, and no one really knew, but we could guess. And so you have a book come out, and 90 days later, it's gone. And if you don't make enough sales in that time, gone is gone. Like, Amazon wasn't really a thing yet, or if it was, it was just really starting. So your sales were just dead. And then Borders failed, and we were left with just Barnes and Noble as the only really national chain, but they still followed pretty much the same model. And publishers were able, when a book came out, to buy space on shelves and buy space on end caps and promote their books. And that was good for publishers, it was good for authors, but it was bad for Barnes and Noble, because they were potentially selling space on their shelves to books that were not moving, right? Books would just sit there. And eventually the contract would expire and the books would go back to the distributor, and that was sort of the end of it. With COVID, Barnes & Noble took the opportunity to change their model. They changed the way that they are distributing books. So it is very difficult to get books on their shelves at all. They simply reduced the amount of floor space. They reduced the number of shelves that they're carrying, the number of shelves that they have on display, and they're not picking up as many books. And so it used to be, if you had a book come out from a traditional publisher of relatively normal size, I mean, even mid-size and smaller. I've worked for, I mean, Solaris is not a very large publisher. Pyre is not a very large publisher. Bain is pretty big, but not huge. You know, Tor is really large. If you had a book come out from any of those publishers, it would guarantee 1 to 2 copies of that book on every on the shelves of every Barnes and Noble in the U.S. And that was your exposure. That was the way that you would get sales, because, you know, if a book's not on display, it's not going to sell. COVID shut everything down. Nobody sold a lot of books during that time, even though a lot more books were being sold. There were a lot more people staying home and reading. With the shutdowns, people weren't going to stores to buy books. So they were only buying authors that they already knew, and they were only buying books that they knew they wanted to buy. You know, there is no browsing culture on Amazon. You mentioned, you know, bookstores in Spain are basically, you know, display shelves for Amazon. It's true. But you know, when the bookstores were closed, what we saw was that it still led to a lot fewer sales. Like, people, I know people who got books or got titles on the New York Times bestseller list at that time with numbers that would have been considered utter failures at any time. You know, prior to that, you know, selling that many books would have been, you know, a terrible, terrible week, but that was enough to get them onto the New York Times bestseller list. And so, you know, the math just changed. And so Barnes and Noble changed the way that they distribute books. It's no longer guaranteed. Like, I think my last three books, only Nightwatch got into most stores. Wraithbound and Valhalla's both, maybe a third, maybe a quarter, maybe a fifth. It depends, you know. And it's a lot more difficult to, no publisher has figured out how to get their books to guarantee their books on BNN shelves. Some publishers are doing a better job of it than others. I don't mind naming names. Orbit has done an amazing job. Most Orbit books do in fact get on shelves in the US. But most Bain and Tor books do not, with some exceptions. Like, you know, obviously Brandon, every book is going to get out. Victoria Schwab, every book is going to get out. People who are already established in the industry, but it is a terrible time to be a debut author, because there's no way, like the thing that traditional could sell you was that guarantee of bookshelf exposure and some degree of marketing. And that's not a guarantee anymore. They can't give it to you the way that they used to. So yeah, it's a tough time.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've touched on so many things, but I don't know where I want to go in so many directions, but since you mentioned covers, let's talk covers and, sure. And we'll meander and come back to things. Sure. So, again, you and I come from a background of the traditional Dungeons and Dragons novels, Forgotten right. Realms, Dragonlance. Those Dragonlance covers, the originals by Larry Elmore, were amazing covers. And I don't think covers have reached that level. Again, I've got a dedicated signed print by Larry Elmore in my office here at home because, you know, as a kid, you saw those covers, they sold you the book straight away. And like Drew mentioned before, these days, so many covers are so generic that I'm not even sure they're not AI generated. They look so similar from one author to the next.
Yeah, you know, they really have, they've declined. And I don't know how much of that is driven by consumer expectation and how much of it is driven by like just the publisher taste, trying to, you know, differentiate themselves from the past, I guess, you know, is the way to say it. But I mean, I've been very happy with my covers from Bane, and I don't, of course, have one in front of me, but the cover for Wraithbound, I've been very happy with. The Nightwatch covers, they're Todd Lockwood's. I love those. But I really don't think, you're right that they've become very generic. That comes from the motion of young adult into adult. The line between them has really blurred. And so when you 10 years ago went to the young adult shelf and looked at the covers that were there, those are the covers that are now being used to market adult novels because those readers have grown up. They are now the adult audience. Publishers are just continuing the trend. Now, again, like we've said, the whole romanticy thing, it's the same authors. So it's, you know, young adult novelists and readers have become adult novelists and readers. And those themes of you know, romance and young love and all that stuff, that's just become the plot line for most big fantasy novels. So I really think they're following a trend that started a while ago and has just kind of expanded. I don't know how much of it is like my tastes are a little old fashioned and the majority of the market doesn't want that kind of cover anymore. I don't know. But you're right that they've really declined, in my opinion. But yeah, like Elmore, Lockwood, that whole breed of evocative illustrative covers, you know, that's a generational thing. And I think that things change as they go along. Even like, you know, Anne Leckie through Orbit, her original covers were very evocative science fiction covers, and they're re-releasing those books now with just sort of graphic covers that don't tell you anything about the book. They're just shapes. So it's a trend. Will it last? no trend does. But yeah, it's definitely an issue. It's a thing where just by looking at books, I can tell you whether or not I'm interested in them because they're boring, you know.
So two things. Sorry to interrupt you. Two things. One quick answer, and then you can address Drew's question here from the chat. The first one, do you think that publishers are afraid to take risks, generally speaking? They rather just try to sell what they think is going to sell. And there is this kind of, you know, these covers we've talked about from the 80s that, you know, that's an 80s thing, and that thing is done and gone, and we don't want to go back to it. So they're sticking to this sort of more neutral, for want of a better word, kind of covers. And then you can address Tim's question from the chat here.
Could you repeat the first part of that question again?
So are publishers...
Oh, right. Scared of taking risks. Yeah. That has always been true. That's not new. And when you see the industry from the inside, it gets a little, like when you learn how the sausage gets made, it's a little annoying because it's like there are many publishers who have made their buck by signing aspiring writers to, frankly, bad contracts and just kind of throwing the books out there on the shelf and then seeing what sticks and then throwing their marketing muscle behind the things that stick. And they make most of their money off of one or two successful authors. And then they use those funds to prospect for other authors. But I mean, the supply of aspiring writers is very, very big. And it's easier to just sign a new person and see if their thing sticks than it is to put backing behind the things that they've already signed. And so that's not new. Are they afraid to take risks? They're convinced that they're doing the right thing. Like Hollywood doesn't really take risks anymore. They just keep churning out sequels. But if that were the case in publishing, you would just see 30 Brandon Sandersons, and you don't. Like, it's very difficult to sell. It's difficult to sell a series in New York now. It's almost
there's a lot of people doing the whole multiverse thing now.
Yeah. That's true, but well, okay. So, what are some names that, like?
You want to go there?
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind.
So, Brent Weeks. To me, Brent Weeks is, I don't want to say copying Sanderson, but the magic system that he had in the Lightbringer series, and the fact that series finished with a hint that there is some sort of universe traveling thing going on, and now he's going back to the Night Angel trilogy world is sort of doing that.
That's true.
Someone like Trudy Canavan, which I really enjoyed her first Dark Magician trilogy, her last series is about people traveling through worlds in this sort of medieval setting. So I think there's a fair amount of latching onto that whole multiverse thing, which actually Moorcock did way back in the 60s, but now it has become a thing.
Yeah, well, okay, so I mean, Brent Weeks predates Sanderson, but I mean, maybe he's adding on to that. I actually haven't read Lightbringer yet, I think I can see why it would be attractive to like try to do your own Cosmere. It's hard to deny that like there's a lot of attraction there, but if you look at what Tor and Daw and Del Rey are acquiring and advertising, it does not really resemble traditional epic fantasy. The only trad epic that is really getting any kind of traction or push is stuff that was established prior to, I don't know, the last 10 years, I want to say. Like the late aughts was kind of the end of new traditional epic fantasy that got a lot of support from the publishers that then led to a lot of success for the author. The Pat Rothfusses, the Sandersons, Weeks, you know, Peter V. Brett, that crew. There really hasn't been a lot of new stuff like that since then. I think a lot of people are, I think publishing is trying to do a thing that is not, that the market is not necessarily there for, but they're not really following. Like, I just got back from Dragonsteel, and I cannot name for you another author that would draw that much attention other than Robert Jordan. And in a lot of ways, they're sequential. You know, those are, Sanderson picked up Jordan's audience, fan base. So, yeah, I don't know that that's, I don't know. It's hard to say.
And if you could answer Drew's sure. question, sorry.
Thank yeah, you. No problem. Attending conventions, worthwhile for authors to sell, get exposure for your books. It depends on the convention.
I've bought books from authors I met at conventions that I didn't know anything about.
Sure.
But I don't know if I'm the old one out.
I know. I sell books at conventions all the time. I don't know from a financial perspective if it's worth it. Like, I, again, just got back from Dragonsteel. Selling 50 books does not financially justify the cost of going to Dragonsteel. But potentially the exposure long term, like if those people become larger Tim Akers fans and they go back and read my other 13 books, then yeah, you know, it does become valuable. I think that conventions are valuable for networking with other authors, with editors, with agents, to know what's going on in the industry. I think that's a valuable thing. When I started in the industry, there's a dealer room, and there were booksellers who came to those dealer rooms and sold books from the authors that were there. Those booksellers are mostly gone, and they have been replaced by people selling their own books. You'd have to ask those people, because I've never done that. But I don't think that you can possibly sell enough books to justify the cost, but it is a way of getting exposure. That said, there are a lot of people in that dealer room, and all of them are selling their one book or their five books. And there's nothing in that interaction that can tell you whether or not that's a good book. The way that I mostly sell my books at conventions is by saying, read the first paragraph. And if that can't sell a book, then you've written the first paragraph wrong. So, exposure doesn't pay my bills, but it does help pay tomorrow's bills potentially. You know, lack of exposure. I've said since the beginning of this of me being in this industry, the enemy is not Amazon or bookstores or editors or any of that. The enemy is obscurity, because there are so many new authors. Even when it was just before independent publishing was a thing, when it was just traditional publishing, look, they were, you know, in the early aughts, traditional publishers were putting out, just in science fiction and fantasy, like 60 books a month. And there's no way that any fan is going to read all of those books. And so you're stuck trying to sell your book to a fairly small audience. And even if you sell a book, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to get reviewed, you know, or that people are going to like tell their friends about it. I mean, my second novel, Horns of Ruin, it came out just as Borders was collapsing. And I mean, literally just, it was at the point where a lot of publishers had stopped selling books to Borders because they knew what was going to happen. And the publisher that I was working with, Pyre, was still selling books to Borders. And so, you know, my book went on shelves, and then like a week and a half, 2 weeks later, Borders declared bankruptcy and they held a fire sale. And the way that worked is people went in and bought every book that they were even vaguely interested in. So I sold a lot of copies of that book, but it went into a TBR pile of like 30 books. And so if they got around to reading it, you know, it was like 2 years later. And by then, you know, I couldn't write in that series anymore because Nobody was reading the book and reviewing it, so other people weren't seeing the book. Plus, terribly, all of that, the money that was spent on those books, went to other liens. Other people had better debt liens on Borders than the publishers did. So like real estate agents and stuff, that money didn't go to my publisher. So that book just cratered, you know, it was never going to earn out because they didn't get any of the money from it. So yeah, it was a rough go, but, you know, lack of exposure is a guaranteed way to not pay your bills. But it doesn't, you're right. It does not pay your bills directly. And I've run into problems. Like I do game design writing. I'm actually a fairly expensive guy to hire. There are games that I play where I've gone to the publisher of those games and say, hey, I love your setting. I'd love to work with you. And they love hearing that, you know, and I've got a pretty good CV and stuff. And they've said, so, you know, what are your prices? And I'll name them. And that's the last I hear from them. Which I understand, like I'm not super cheap, but I'm not going to lower my price just to sell to somebody that I, you know, I love your game kind of thing. So,
I could take the conversation in many directions because, so by the way, just, you know, to put it out, I'm really loving this conversation too. So thank you again. But, let me backtrack here. What's happened to, I think there's still, I don't know if it's a bunch of us nostalgics out there, but I still think there's a corner of the market yearning for the classic elves, dwarves, orcs. You know, I think Salvatore is still, each one of his novels goes on the New York Times best-selling list. Is he the only one because he's been doing it for so long? Or is there still a craving for that really fantastical D&D type thing?
I think there's still demand for it. I think a lot of that demand is being answered by independent publishers, independent writers, or small press writers. Because again, like they're able to produce stuff at a pretty high level, or high volume is maybe a little more accurate. I definitely think there's still a demand for it. And I think that's a demand that's not being met. Again, you know, there is demand for traditional epic fantasy. There's demand for romantasy, and they're just putting all their eggs in the basket that is so far currently paying off for them best, without like supporting a wider, more diverse demand set. So I really think that there's definitely demand for it. I think it's being kind of broadly ignored. And I think that eventually that'll come back to haunt them. But for now, that's just the nature of the market.
And I get the impression, and I could be very wrong here, that maybe, you know, because one thing I have to say for this more modern, less fantastical fantasy, I think the character work is superb in authors like, you know, George Martin, Robin Hobb, even Joe Abercrombie. You know, he's doing his thing, but the character work is superb, which is something that I had never seen in Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms, that sort of stuff. Is it harder to do great character work in this sort of very epic traditional fantasy setting? Or is that a thing that wasn't the focus at the time?
Then? That wasn't the focus. And, you know, I think people think of writing as being like one skill. It's not. It's like 30. Because, you know, writing a good character is different than writing a good plot. Writing a good world is different than writing good action scenes. It's different than good, you know, all of these are individual skills. You know, learning how to write dialogue is its own skill set. And so learning how to write good characters is maybe a skill that some of those early writers didn't necessarily have. Early Asimov, the characters are very, very flat. But as time went on, writers learned how to do that better, and you know, have gotten better at writing character stuff. So I agree with you. Like, I think good character really trumps a lot of stuff. I just wish that they could get good characters in more interesting worlds. You know, and I like George Martin. I like what he did. I don't think that it should be the only thing that is being published. And what's interesting about it is that when he did the early Game of Thrones stuff, was that it was utterly unique to what had come before. And people have tried to replicate it with, you know, varying amounts of success. And it would be nice if he finished it. And if he did finish it, he would sell a lot of books. So, you know, but like more fantastical, Tolkien-esque fantasy, people are still doing it. But again, that demand is being met in other places with other kinds of books. I mean, you know, we talk about people aren't doing that kind of thing anymore, but I think like Nicholas Eames, Kings of the Wild, I mean, that's a brilliant book. And it definitely is like, you like D&D? Here's some D&D. So it's still being done. It's just, it's rare. Now, Salvatore, the reason that all of his books hit New York Times bestseller list is, again, nostalgia. Like, people know what they're going to get, and they get exactly that. And I think that really kind of is what drives his numbers.
But he cannot be appealing to any new audience when you are 35 novels into his series. No one is going to pick up the latest Salvatore book, isn't it? Right. It's people like me who started reading it when they were 13 years old back in 93.
Yeah.
And we started with Icewind Dale trilogy.
Well, and I mean, like, this is probably heresy, but like Michael Moorcock, a lot of people love Michael Moorcock. I like Michael Moorcock okay, but I did not read it until I was in my 30s. And I read it. I read the first, I can't remember which book it was, but I read it. I was like, well, that was okay. I wish I had read it when I was 14, because it would have been the best novel I'd ever seen when I was 14. But it didn't, you know, it didn't have the same kind of impact on me that I think it would have had on me when I was younger. And there are a lot of authors like that. And again, like, you know, like you say, 35 books is intimidating, but he still makes the New York Times bestseller list. So there are still plenty of guys like you out there buying.
Yeah, the book,
it's just, as there should be.
It's just people like me, isn't it? Yeah, it's just, okay. Yeah, no, I get that. But yeah, I think I agree with you, Moorcock. Like, I've read it last year, or the whole Elric series, and it's like this is poor. Like this is so, it's almost like childish. This is kind of like the D&D campaigns I used to run when I didn't have a clue what I was doing. You know, I just got talking swords, you know, weird beings, you travel through universes without any sense of character, plot, structure, just, you know, jumping from place to place.
Yeah,
but I think Moorcock was aware, because, you know, he said that he's more of an ideas person rather than
an action
finished guy. Product thing.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to remember, like, Moorcock came into this kind of early on, and was reacting to a very specific kind of thing. You know, Tolkien, Brooks, McKiernan. And then you had Moorcock come along and be like, nah, not that, you know, or more along the lines of Howard or something like that. So it's hard to, as a modern reader, go back and look at that stuff and be like, okay, how would I have reacted to it then? If I only had access to the following things, would I have been impressed by this? Would I have found it, you know, interesting or fascinating? It's like Lovecraft. Lovecraft is fine for what it is. But for what it was at the time, it's mind boggling. And I mean, I love Lovecraft. But you know, you can see the rough edges when you go back and read some of his older stuff, just because he's just not, you know, this is undescribable. Well,
yeah,
that's one way to do it, I guess.
Yeah.
But that's sort of the thing.
But I guess then what I'm getting, the sense I'm getting from this is that kind of fantasy has got its stages, and you're better off discovering Dragonlance and Forgotten Realms in your early teens than you are in your 40s. And I think probably the genre matures as you mature, and you shouldn't start necessarily with Malazan. You should start with, Weiss and Hickman.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And it's all a question. I mean, like, part of my problem as a fantasy writer and fantasy reader is I grew up in a very religious home. And it was at a time when there was a lot of mistrust in that community toward fantasy and stuff, which is ironic that I ended up, this. But so a lot of those early books I did not have access to because my parents were very much, you cannot read that stuff. And that's how I ended up starting to write, because like I went through the list of books that they were willing to let me read very quickly. And so I just started writing my own stuff just to entertain myself. And it wasn't until I owned a car and had a paycheck in high school that I'm like, I'm just going to read whatever I want to read, but there are a lot of books that are sort of foundational that I just missed because I grew up kind of in the middle of nowhere, kind of without anyone else who was also a fantasy fan in my circle of friends. In a sort of a limited area. So, I do wish that I had read Moorcock younger. I've had people say, oh, Moorcock is clearly an influence on you. I'm like, no, it's not. It's not even possible. Like, I didn't read him until my fourth book was out. So, it's challenging.
Maybe indirectly. Indirectly. Else.
Well, he influenced people who influenced me. Honestly, like that's what it is. So.
Let's take this back, because I have this question in the back of my head. But so I've been to mostly Comic Cons, but in a couple of them, there's been writers out there. So I met Scott Lynch and I met Brian McClellan, a couple of other people. What's it like from a writer's perspective? You're only there signing books for like an hour. So did you just show up for that hour, or like you were alluding to before, there's something else behind the scenes that we don't get to see as the general public going there?
It depends on the convention. So like Comic Cons are very isolating events because you are just there for your time signing. Or if you've been given a booth, you're there for, just that one day, and you're only there behind the booth, and you do your thing and then you leave. So that's not really the same, but like Worldcon, World Fantasy Convention, writing by its nature is a very isolating job. Like I'm in my basement right now and I live in Chicago and I know very few other writers in my area. And I only see my other author friends either online or at one of the, two or three conventions that I still go to a year. So that sense of community only exists at these conventions. That's again the networking aspect of it, but also just camaraderie, talking to people who honestly understand what it's like to face endless rejection over and over again, and then eventually, getting some measure of success out of it. So, Comic-Cons are a very weird experience because it's very much just you're in front of people and they pass in front of you in a sort of a blur, and you be as friendly as you can, but then once it's over, it's over. Dragon Seal's the same way. I'm behind the booth the entire time, selling books, talking to people, pitching books, and then I go back to my hotel and I have a drink and I go to bed because I just need to sleep, because tomorrow is the same thing. It's a marathon, or it's a marathon that you sprint. So it can be tough.
Right. And the other thing I wanted to, or just to hear what you have got to say, I'm not talking to you, I'm just listening to what you're saying, and I'm learning a lot. So thank you again. It's a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, I interviewed Holly Tinsley, who's a sort of grim, dark by gaslight author. She's an SPFBO finalist. Mm-hmm. Obviously, self-publishing is not what it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I think there's a lot of quality to be found in the self-publishing world. And I think what I got from her was that for her, getting traditionally published wasn't necessarily an end goal, because she was doing fine as it was. Yeah. I mean, what's your perception? What have you seen? How has that changed over the years?
I mean, that has definitely changed since I started. And a lot of it comes from, again, like I said, what traditional publishers can offer you has really diminished over the years. Like, if my publisher can't get me onto bookshelves, they're not doing a lot for me. If they're not marketing my book, they're not doing a lot for me. Now, what they are doing is covering a lot of the costs and paying me, right? So when I sign a contract with somebody, I get X amount of money. I get a high quality cover if they give me a high quality cover. I get a developmental edit pass. I get a copy edit pass. And I get some amount of marketing, whether that marketing is directly through the publisher or through the publisher's publicists, like they have in-house publicists, or, you know, like this interview right now only exists essentially because Bain hooked us up, right? That's how that happened.
I don't know if I would call it an interview, but thank you.
Well, you know, that's the only way that these things occur. And so, you know, they do give something to their authors. That product has, I would say, diminished in value over years, and the value that's available to you as a self-published author, the tools that are available to you are a lot more, but still, like, when you go self-publishing, you have to put a lot more money into it. And if you don't have that money available, it's a lot harder to justify. But I mean, like, the dynamic has changed so dramatically. You know, there was a time when you would say, oh, it's a self-published book, therefore it's no good, because they could not sell to a traditional publisher. A lot of traditional publishers, Orbit in particular, and some others, have done a good job of identifying self-published books that have done really well and signing them to traditional contracts and getting them onto shelves and stuff. So they've identified books that are already succeeding and then, you know, acquiring them and moving on, like Alexander Darwin or Evan Winter, Rage of Dragons. You know, those are good books.
It's a low risk strategy again.
Yes, this book already sells. So we're just going to buy the book that's already selling. So why not? Here's some money, you know. Yeah. So at the same time, like, the tools that are available to self-publishers there's more of them, like I said, but the barrier to entry is a lot lower. Like, it's cheaper, you know, and it's easier to get a decent cover, and I have just a decent cover, not a great cover, and publish your book. And it doesn't, there's nothing behind actually doing it. Like, okay. So when Pat Rothfuss announced that he was going to release a novella after 9 years of not releasing anything, I was a little angry about that. So I said, I'm going to publish a novella. I'm going to write and publish a novella before that novella comes out. And I did. It's called Servant of a Pale Sword. I think it's a good story, but it is literally like I sat down and wrote for a week, put it away for a couple of weeks, came back, read it again, made some edits, got my wife, who is a graphic designer, to make me a cover, and I put it out there. Like, that is almost zero effort. And that could not have happened 10 years ago. You know, so it's a lot easier to just put out whatever you want. So what I'm saying is that there are a lot more self-published books out there than there used to be. Like, there used to at least be, you got to pay somebody to do your developmental edit, and you still have to do that, but you don't absolutely have to do it. Like, it's possible to just write a book and put it out there, you know? And so the quality has gotten both higher and lower. There, you know, mm-hmm. the bell curve has widened. And so it's still harder, in my opinion, to like get attention for a self-published book than it used to be, but there are more tools to get, you know, noticed. There's Amazon ads and so forth. Yeah. But like Amazon has changed the way that they charge ads, show ads, and so forth, because it used to be their client was traditional published authors, publishing houses. That used to be their client. And now their client is self-published authors. And so like the math is different because they have jobs, you know, they don't have to necessarily turn a profit. They don't have to show value. And so the way that they do their algorithms and stuff has changed. People have talked about that, you know, in other venues, but you know, it is both easier and harder to get noticed to self-publish author than it used to be.
Yeah.
It's both easier and harder to self-publish a book. It is both easier and harder to get into trad because you know, they're more desperate for quality. Yeah, there are more roads, but those roads are more crowded. So
a couple of things there, because I heard mixed reviews about Amazon ads, but I think we've got Alex somewhere here watching who's an aspiring author. So how necessary is an agent? How does one go about finding an agent these days?
If you intend to traditionally publish, an agent is almost 100% required. Like, it is possible to sell unagented. There are publishing houses that will accept unagented submissions. There are publishing houses that will have a specific period of the year where they'll look at unagented manuscripts, but it's very difficult. So if trad is your goal, then an agent is very highly recommended. How to get an agent? Start by figuring out what agent, you know, you're interested in. Figure out what agents are requiring or are acquiring the kind of thing that you want to write. That happens at conventions. That happens by looking at the trad writers that you like, that are similar, that are comps to what you write, and finding out who their agents are. And there's multiple ways to do that, but figure out what agents are selling books that you like. The best way to do that, there's a magazine called Locus, L-O-C-U-S, that is the industry rag, essentially. And it every month has new and notable. It has all of the book deals that have gone through, who has sold what to whom, and who their representation is. So you can look through that and say, well, this person, you know, Joshua Bilmes, has just sold a young adult novel to this publisher for a nice deal, you know, and there's code there. That means six figures, you know, or actually means five figures. A very nice deal is six figures. So yeah, there's a way of figuring out who is selling what, and then you just look online and find out what they're acquiring and when they're acquiring it. Follow them on Twitter, X, you know, just follow them on the various social media, and they'll tell you what they're looking for. The way that I met Joshua was by going to World Fantasy Con in Madison and just striking up a conversation in the bar, essentially. That is one of those things that conventions really can't replace, where just you meet people and you find a way to connect with them. So I would say if trad is your goal, I recommend it. And the best way to do it is to, you know, figure out who to target and figure out what they want. And they have submission policies just like any other group. So,
right. Okay. No, I understand that. I literally just stopped my train of thought because I have my next question lined up, and then that has gone, which is highly irritating. So here we go. That's Alex, our aspiring author. So
Alex, funny story. Your profile pic is it's clip art, right? And that is the clip art that I used for the cover for Servant of a Pale Sword, which is the novella I was just talking about. So if you look at the cover for that, I had my wife modify it significantly, but that's the clip art that I used.
Oh, there you go. And thank you for that, because my question has come back into my brain. That's fantastic. Thank you for that. So is it the case, because I'm a teacher and I've got two young boys, and I can see how I think video games have replaced reading to a large degree. Kids these days don't read. So I think we're living at a time where reading maybe is at an all-time low. And like you mentioned before, barriers to entry for new authors are at an all-time low as well. So is that the case? And if so, you know, how does one make it? So yeah, it's just luck, getting lucky?
It's a supply-demand thing. The supply of aspiring authors well outstrips the demand from readers. There is definitely some luck involved, but in some ways you make your own luck, right? You need to be persistent. You need to be kind of immune to criticism, because, you know, you're going to send your books out and they're going to get rejected over and over again. And you're just going to have to be like, well, I believe in this thing and keep at it. So yeah, it's challenging. Like, I wouldn't want to be starting now, but it's, no, like Joshua just had an interview with Brandon and their publisher at Tor. And he said, look, if you're getting into trad publishing, you are already in the top 2% of aspiring writers. And you know, even then you're still facing a big uphill battle, because so many books come out and so few of them succeed. It's just not like it is a numbers game, and the deck is stacked against you. But it's not just luck, because there are a lot of things that you can do to align yourself to do, you know, write a good book and eventually someone will find you. It may take time. It may take a lot of effort, but just keep at it and you'll get there eventually.
It's the whole thing that luck is where preparation and opportunity meet, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, my luck came largely from being in the right place at the right time to meet Joshua. But that happened because that was the end of like a 5-year cycle of me trying to get into the industry, writing short stories, getting rejected, figuring out how conventions worked, going to a fair number of conventions before that happened. So, I mean, it's, you know, you can't, it's not the lottery, because it's not pure luck. But you still have to like put yourself out there and understand there's going to be a lot of rejection. There's going to be a lot of the numbers not coming up for you. And even after, you know, you make your first sale, there's still a lot you don't have control over. Your cover artist, the publicity department, all of these things are still stacked against you in a certain way. So it's rough.
Yeah. I just want to talk to you a little bit about you. So you've got your Burn Cycle, which is more like a steampunk setting, and then you've got the Hallowed War, which is, I'm assuming, it's a bit more traditional fantasy setting. So what makes you go into one setting or the other?
Part of that was marketing, honestly. Like, the Burn Cycle stuff, we say steampunk, I wrote it as a new weird thriller. Like, I wrote it as what I call urban fantasy, which is not urban fantasy, but just like fantasy, but if it were set in the Victorian time, and people call that steampunk, and it's not really. But anyway, the point is, like, that was what I initially wanted to do. Those books didn't do great because they were too weird for steampunk readers. Like, they would pick them up and be like, this isn't steampunk. There's a lot of weird stuff happening. There's a lot of, you know, what I consider fantasy stuff, monsters and things that are not really in line with traditional steampunk. And they were too steampunk for like weird fantasy authors. So I wrote what I wanted to write, but it, you know, those books have a lot of fans, and I get asked a lot about when I'm going to like write the next Baradon book. And I'm like, as soon as the other ones, you know, make a lot of money, because this is my job. You know, I can't just do this for recreation. So then I took a break. There's a about a 5-year break between the last Burn Cycle book and the first Hallowed War book. And, you know, I was just trying to write this sort of, I had big ideas for the Hallowed War trilogy, and I'm really happy with how they ended up. But, you know, they did okay, but they didn't do super, super great. And so then, like, I can't write more in that series because it is the nature of a series that the first book is always going to sell the most. Second will sell fewer. You know, no one's going to pick up book 3 first. So you can always tell your sales are declining. Now, that's over time, those numbers can get high enough that it's worth writing more books in that series because there's enough inertia. But if you don't have that inertia, it doesn't work out. So then you got to change it up a little bit. So, like, when I finished the Hallowed War trilogy in 2015, 16, I gave my agent what's called a pitch sheet, which was like 5 ideas that I had. And he went through them. And that's part of the agent's job, is knowing what is popular, what's selling to editors, to kind of understand the marketing aspects of things. And he went through that sheet and came up with, through his agency, you know, he passed it around and stuff, said, well, one of these 2 or 3 books are probably the next book that you should write. And I picked one of those, and that was Wraithbound, which is the book that just came out in February of this year. And so I started writing Wraithbound, and then I woke up one morning and this other book entered my head, fully formed. And that was Nightwatch. And so I sat down. It takes me about 6 to 8 months to write a book. I wrote the first draft of Nightwatch in 10 weeks. Not normal for me. And so I turned that into him and was like, look, this isn't what we discussed, but this is what I've written. And he had feedback, and we did some revision and stuff. And then that went out and sold. And after that had sold, and after the second book in that series had sold, that's when we sold Wraithbound. So, like, there's a lot of, part of it is like what I feel like writing at the time. Part of it is what sells to editors. And part of it is what my agent thinks is going to potentially sell well. So there's a lot of, you know, marketing kind of inside baseball stuff that goes into those decisions. But
so are you now playing some balancing act between writing what you want and writing what is going to sell? Because it's your job. You need to pay the bills. You need to eat. So
yeah,
do you feel like maybe at times you're not necessarily writing what you want?
Yes. And I mean, that's almost always a mistake, because your lack of love for the thing shows through, or your lack of familiarity with, you know, with the product comes out. My agent has been trying to get me to write a young adult novel since we met. I have produced for him the first third of 5 books. And every time I turn it in, you know, he takes me aside and says, this is okay, but it's not really young adult. I'm like, well, I don't know what to do. Like, I can't help you. And so I have, you know, a bunch of young adult novels that are just lying around, not going anywhere, because they're not really young adult novels. I don't read young adult. There's enough money in them that I keep trying to produce one. But, and I've stopped that. Like, the last one of those was 6 years ago, probably. And I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm only going to write what I actually feel like I have. And again, like, I've been at this for 20 years. After a certain point, you're just like, screw it. I'm just going to do what I want to do. And if anybody wants to buy it, that's great. And if they don't, that's not my problem. And, you know, that's what I've been doing with the Servant of a Pale Blade and those shorter novellas. Those are exactly what I want to be writing. There is nobody standing between me and the reader at that point. And that, again, is an advantage with trad versus indie. You know, with traditional publishing, you got to sell it to your agent. Your agent needs to sell it to the acquisition editor. Mm-hmm. The acquisition editor has to sell it to their boss, the the publisher. The publisher then sells it to the marketing team. The marketing team sells it to the distributor. The distributor then sells it to the bookseller. The bookseller maybe sells it to a reader. When I put a book out myself, I go up to the readers and say, here's the book. Is this what you want to read? Buy it. And that's it. Like, there's nobody else involved in the process. And so, you know, at each of those, in the traditional market, at each of those levels, there's a certain amount of loss of signal and sort of massaging of the message and stuff that gets in the way of the actual product. We talked about George Martin, like the Hallowed War trilogy. That was my take on George Martin. That was, what if George Martin was a horror novel, essentially? And that's, you know, the traditional pitch for it. Turns out, you know, that does okay, but people who want George Martin don't want to be terrified all the time. And people who want horror don't necessarily want all of the battle scenes and the knights and all that stuff. So I did a little bit of both of those, and it's sort of challenging. But, you know, I've gotten to the point in my career where I am just writing what I want to write. I actually had a conversation with Joshua last week where we were talking about what I'm doing next. And I said, you know, what is selling? And he listed for me the things that are selling. And like, I'm not going to write any of that. I'm just not. Like, I am either not capable of writing it because it's not what interests me, or I don't want my name associated with, you know, with a romantic thing. And that's what's in bookstores. And I'm not qualified to do that. So
yeah, romance is definitely the biggest selling thing.
Yeah.
Since ever.
Yeah.
Since ever.
Oh, it is the 800-pound gorilla. So.
So talking back in general about fantasy, I've got the feeling that particularly of late, I think fantasy, everything has been done. I think the only thing left to do is for the Dark One to actually win. Is for Morgoth to win.
But you just described Mistborn, because
I disagree with that.
The pitch for Mistborn was what if the Dark Lord had won, and we're left with the world after that. And yeah, you're right. Like if the hero was Morgoth, then.
But I think for me, I hear what you're saying, but for me, the premise from Mistborn fell flat because it didn't, to me, it just didn't feel like our heroes were living in a, you know, oppressed world. You know, if you think Middle Earth, if Morgoth had won, you know, there wouldn't be cities of humans going to balls and rich, you know, just the premise fell flat from the word go for me.
Yeah, right.
So, maybe what I'm talking about is that moment where you get to the final battle and the Dark Lord actually wins.
Right. And then it just ends there.
Yeah. I think that's the only thing left to do.
Yeah. And I wouldn't want to read that. So I'm probably not going to write it. I think that there's always stuff to do with character. There's always stuff to do with, you know, different kinds of worlds and magic systems. I think there's always, like, it's a genre that by its nature anything can happen in, and so if we're seeing retreads of the same thing over and over again, that's a failure of imagination on the part of the authors. You know, that's not a failure of fantasy as a genre. And that was the whole thing behind like the new weird movement, China Mieville and company, where they're just like, it can be anything. You do whatever you want to do. Don't feel like you have to do a specific thing, and just go. And that was sort of a freeing thing, but it also meant it was very like, genres exist for a reason. They're there so that readers know what they're getting. And so if you say, well, anything, literally anything can happen, then readers are picking it up and being like, well, this is what I was hoping to happen, you know? And so they get discouraged and they give up. So I think that's ultimately why New Weird never really got anywhere. It was because people didn't know what to expect of it. Has everything been done? No, I don't think so. I think there are always interesting things that can and will occur in books. I don't know, you know, all creativity is hiding your sources. It's just a matter of like finding new and interesting ways to combine old tropes into new things. Yeah, so I don't know.
Because, well, we've talked a little bit that you've written in, but not quite, the steampunk setting. Because I picked up a very limited reading of that, but I picked up James, one of James Blaylock's novels, who's meant to be the Godfather.
Yeah.
And I didn't find very much steam or very much punk in the novel. So I don't know if it's my failure to see what was there.
No, that's a matter of naming conventions. Like that, the whole steampunk thing comes out of, you know, cyberpunk thing. And I think they do share a certain amount of origin story. Like one of the things that's attractive about the Victorian era in general is that it was one of the last times that science was fully available to the average Joe. Like the first guy to fly built his plane in a bicycle shop, you know, and the most recent similar thing was with the advent of computer science, where anybody could go out and get a Trash 800 and potentially build really interesting products out of nothing. And so those both served as the origin between cyberpunk and steampunk as genres. I think, you know, like Sherry Priest, steampunk is a little more steam oriented, maybe a little more punky, but like the words steam and punk don't actually mean anything in that context. They're just they're referencing cyberpunk, which was its own kind of thing. Cyberpunk's a fascinating thing. Like I got my start as a writer and a reader in cyberpunk. And what William Gibson did was this really interesting product that changed the way that I thought about science fiction forever. And then a bunch of authors came on and said, well, let's take the framework of that, the setting of that, the, you know, the moving pieces, the props of cyberpunk, and write a bunch of books and call them cyberpunk. And they weren't really. Like, they were not thematically cyberpunk. They were sort of displays of cyberpunk. And it didn't, for me, work. Like, there are a lot of cyberpunk authors that I don't like. But I still think that, like, Gibson's early stuff was some of the best science fiction that was written in the last 50 years. So, yeah, it's... steampunk's the same way. Like there are a couple of like books that are sort of fundamental to that genre that don't really fit into anyone else's definition of steampunk. And then a bunch of people are like, well, bowler hats and steam engines, and that's steampunk. No, that wasn't what it was meant to be particularly. So yeah.
Okay. I get that. I think kind of just to wrap things up, and not because I haven't enjoyed the conversation, or because I want to get out of here, not at all. But what books or what authors would you recommend within fantasy that is obviously not the well-trodden path?
Okay, so
who should I be reading next year?
If you like sword and sorcery, Howard Andrew Jones, his two most recent, Lord of the Broken Land and City of Marble and Blood, are really great sort of serialized books. Dave Butler, his Witchy Eye series, fascinating stuff.
I'm talking to him in about 10 days time.
Yeah, Dave's a very smart dude, and he's got really an interesting way of approaching fantasy. But the name that I recommend to everybody, and I think is the most underappreciated fantasy author of the last 30 years, is Daniel Abraham. Now, Dan has had his career end, I think, three times. And he is half of James S.A. Corey, which wrote The Expanse, which everyone knows The Expanse, or is at least moderately familiar with it. But before that, he wrote a four-book series called The Long Price Quartet, which I love, 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 love. And he also wrote a 5-book series called, what was the series called? The Dragon and the Coin. Book one is The Dragon's Path. Those books are really well written. The characters are really well written. And the world building is very, very top notch. And those are like the big three for me for fantasy. Long Price Quartet. It is also one of my favorite series of all time. And not enough people read that series. That was essentially the end of his fantasy career, theoretically. And so he went on and wrote The Expanse, and The Expanse did really well. So he was able to sell more fantasy novels. That's a great series. Dragon of the Coin, also a really good series. Who else have I read that is not very commonly known?
And if I was to dive into your books, what would you recommend me I start with? Burn Cycle or The Hallowed War?
I would actually say Wraithbound. Or if you have Kindle Unlimited, Servant of a Pale Sword, the novella. I think that's the best thing I've written. And the second novella in that is it's on pre-order right now. So if you don't mind ebooks, those are really good. But other than that, Wraithbound. Wraithbound is the book that I'm pushing. I want it to do, it's done okay, but not great. I want it to do really well because I want to write 20 more books in that series. I think that Wraithbound is some of the best stuff. It's a fantasy novel written at a thriller pace. So fun stuff. That's my pitch.
And once again, thank you ever so much this has been really enlightening, and I've learned a lot. So thank you very much for coming in tonight or this afternoon, as the case may be. Where can people find your stuff? Where can people find you on social media, whatever?
I am everywhere as Tim Akers. And I believe my site is timakers.net. I'm the only living Tim Akers that is anything other than an accountant in Utah or something. So pretty easy to find.
It's a good pen name. Fantastic. Yeah. Right. I think we're going to call it a day here. So thank you everyone that popped in, Drew and Alex and Matt and everyone. And of course, thank you, Tim. It's been amazing. And everyone, take loads and lots of care, and happy Christmas, New Year, whatever. We'll see you soon.
Yep.
Bye.
Bye.
And